Life. My table.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
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 Just this.
Just this.
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
Succession.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Criticism.
Right.
Well.
Peace.
Movement.
This is my mistake. Let me make it good. I raise the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
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 Participation.
Democracy.
Welfare.
Work.
Work.
Leisure.
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 Health.
Education.
Culture.
Culture.
Human rights.
Charter Dana.
Solid.
I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good day to our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a global collection of musicians. I'm Jim Hutchings, joined by Brian Brocheza, with special guest host Jasmine Hintz. Today we have Jeannie Martinson, who's going to be talking with Jasmine about women's inequality in the workplace, among other things. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you, Jim. So Jeannie is a diversity strategist who does research, writes, and delivers presentations about diversity. So welcome to the program, Jeannie.
Thanks for having me.
So just right off the top, how do you notice that discrimination and gender stereotypes still exist for women?
Well, I think when we think about stereotypes, what are stereotypes? They're basically a firmly held belief about a group. And when we have a stereotype, that's at an individual level. You have stereotypes, I have stereotypes, we all have stereotypes. Hopefully they're not creating situations that are negative in our life with relationships. But it's very easy to create those, because when we have... how we learn about things is we learn A is similar to B, A does this, maybe B does this. And when we translate that into relationships with people or ideas of people, if we have a negative situation with someone from a specific group, it's easy for us to extrapolate that everyone from that group is also that way, either positively or negatively. And so when we think about stereotypes that we have about diversity groups, men, women, people on social assistance, people who live in Newfoundland, people live in the north, people who live in the north end of Regina, we have beliefs about groups of people. And when we take a negative action based on that belief, based on that stereotype, that could be discrimination. So sometimes we have stereotypes where discrimination isn't an automatic output of that, but it's very common that we have beliefs about groups, and some of those are particularly harmful. So when you talk about the stereotype about women, I think there's lots of people who still have stereotypes about women's abilities, but it's at an individual level. I don't think that there's broadly across the country of Canada that we could say everyone has negative stereotypes about women, mm-hmm. but it's definitely still there, and individuals have different ones as far as our abilities as a gender.
Yeah, absolutely. You can't say it's everyone, but it's there. So how would you say those discriminations or stereotypes by some people then transfer into the workplace?
I think particularly in non-traditional work, because I've worked in with government clients, I've worked with mining companies, oil and gas, construction, and certain types of industries have stronger negative stereotypes present among their employees and management than in other organizations. So, for example, in the mining industry, there are still miners who think that if women go down in that mine, it's jinxing everybody. And even the idea that you interviewed a woman to be an underground miner, we're all screwed. Like, I mean, that is an extremely strong stereotype about women being good or bad in context to that work. And often women in non-traditional types of jobs, they make it into a non-traditional job, but those stereotypes that some people hold propels them to take negative action, throw away a woman's tools, sabotage her some way as far as her work, call her and tell her that she's not working that shift, so then it looks like she didn't show up for work. You know, these little sabotaging characteristics that sometimes happen in non-traditional fields to just kind of, we don't want women here, let's just get rid of her. Let's make it tough enough, she'll take off.
What about in workplaces, not so much mining, but maybe offices getting into the corporate side of things? How did they face discrimination there?
I think when we, talking about stereotypes, I think one of the challenges for women generally as a stereotype that still seems to be there is that if you have children, especially small children, you're not going to be as serious about your career, that you don't care about your job as much as a woman who doesn't have children or doesn't have small children. And yet we know there's many women in the workplace who have children under the age of 5. And so if people in the workplace, whether it's a supervisor or people that they work with, do not think that she's as capable or as committed, they might not, for example, give her more exciting tasks or projects or totally trust that she's going to kind of carry through.
How does it, now just aside from that, because we're going to focus on that a bit later, but how does it for women and equality numbers wise, and are the ratios are improving for men to women, but so why are we not getting ahead?
When you think of the differences as far as pay, is that what you're referring to?
Pay or numbers-wise, men to women in the workplace?
Well, there's more women than men in the workplace, generally speaking, when we look at the large numbers. There's in some industries, women are much more predominant at a frontline level. And in fact, most industries, you see more women than men at a frontline level. In some industries, particularly financial, even more so credit unions, for example, over banks, credit unions have a lot of women in middle and senior management, but not necessarily often do you see a female CEO of a credit union. So those top two or three jobs tend to be shutouts for women. And in fact, 95% of the CEOs of financial 500s in Canada are held by men. That means there's only 5 women who are in that C-suite, that most senior post. So when we ask, how is it that there's no or very few women CEOs? Well, to have women CEOs, you need to have women VPs. And to have women VPs, you need women middle managers. And so as women move up, you're kind of thinking, how is it that at a middle management level, half of the people are women, and yet we don't seem to get up to that top level? And I think that there's a couple reasons for it. Certainly some of it is the stereotypes that we don't think that, or some people don't think that women will be as totally committed. Some people think that women won't be able to make the tough decisions. Sometimes women themselves don't sacrifice or are willing to sacrifice what the rest of their life for that position. And a lot of most senior roles, that's kind of the idea, is that you give 60% of your life to the workplace and you have a system behind you that supports you. So you look at the most senior CEOs in organizations of the largest companies in Canada, they have support systems. They don't pick up their own laundry. They don't make dinner. They don't plan anything of their personal life. They have people doing that. And that's where we often see male CEOs have support systems as far as their spouse who doesn't have the same intensity of career. And that's often not seen that women should have stay-at-home husbands that support their goals in kind of a senior role. So there's a couple things happening there. I don't think there's one thing. I think it's a multifaceted.
Mm-hmm. You just mentioned sacrifice. Why is it, though, that women are expected to make those sacrifices that for men it just comes so natural? Well, I don't say naturally, but mm-hmm. it's expected of them.
I think it's at a senior level, there mm-hmm. are sacrifices. You don't become CEO of a major corporation without digging in your heels and having to do some serious travel, some serious commitment. But the key is here is that men have a support system behind them that takes care of the other 40% of their life. And women, and we look at some women who are in senior CEO, CFO, CIO roles of corporations who get pregnant and have a baby, and the headline is, how can she be a good mother and a CEO? Where when a man has a child with his wife, no one says, how can he be a good father and be a CEO? We don't even, that question doesn't even come up. But with women, society expects us, if we have children, that our primary focus is still going to be on that family. And at the same time, how can that work? So women at a senior level often take the choice of not having children because of that balance, but also society, we just as a society don't support powerful women who are mothers.
And touching on that then, what do we need to do to break that so that women can have it both? They can have both.
Well, part of it, I think, is one, women supporting women. That's a big thing. Because if you are a mother, you might have some attitudes and opinions of, well, I suffered or I sacrificed to raise my kids for a couple years at home or to be involved with my children's life, and so I sacrificed my career. Or women who have very serious careers saying, you know, I sacrificed having as many children as I wanted or sacrificed having children at all so that I could be a senior partner in this CA firm. And so women are very judgmental about other women who are successful, and I think that's one thing we need to think about. Secondly, we need to think about what is actual balance and requirements when it comes to those senior roles. What is the possibilities around flexibility? And we're moving into a more flexible society because the youngest generation in the workplace, these Gen Ys who are kind of 32, 33 and younger, are demanding that flexibility anyways. When Generation Y becomes CEOs of major corporations, the workplace won't even look like it looks now because they won't put up with that. They won't put up with the sacrifice expected of working that 60 to 80 hours a week that we expect from our most senior executives.
So then would you refer to that as breaking the glass? Like, the glass ceiling is an idea that's currently referred to, that women can only advance so far and they hit the ceiling then where they can't go any further. Would that be something that you would describe then as working to break that ceiling in the future?
Yes. Well, and I think a lot of women move to a certain level in an organization and they get stalled. So what you're referring to is a glass ceiling. And I think some women who want more control or want more success, they just leave. They start their own organizations. And so a lot of women become entrepreneurs because of they want to be successful, but the organizations don't allow them to be successful in the structure that currently exists within that corporation or that organization. So I think when we see some women who are in entrepreneurial roles, that's about, I got as far as I could and they're not letting me go any farther, so I'm out of here and I'm going to create my own destiny. So I think the glass ceiling obviously still exists, or we wouldn't have 95% of CEOs in Canada be male. Like, I mean, it's the year 2012, almost 2013. This hasn't changed much in the last 20 years. So it certainly does still exist as far as the glass ceiling. We look in the context of, in our government systems, of the number of MPs in Canada compared to, that are female compared to men. Our numbers are worse than Rwanda. That is sad. As a Canadian woman, that is sad. That bothers me. And I think it should bother every Canadian.
Is that come down to equal representation of half of the population of the country is women, half the population is men, so shouldn't we have equal representation as well to speak for our women rights?
Well, I think in the context of politics, I think there's a lot of women, reasons why women don't engage in politics is running for politics. One, it's a very nasty business. and there's a lot of mud flying. And so the way politics exists at a national and even a provincial level, a lot of women say, I'm not going to play in that nasty sandbox. I'll be the kind of person behind the scenes supporting initiatives. And that's why women are pulled towards advocacy roles and leadership and advocacy, which they then, for example, present to cabinet. One organization that I'm quite familiar with, BPW Canada, I'm involved here at a provincial and local level, and we often put together briefs that we present to cabinet and the MLAs and MPs. And what's interesting about that is part of one of our initiatives is moving more women into government, in running for government. But also, if you look at yourself, if you are running for an MLA or an MP, some of those same situations arise. If you're a minister, there's a lot of government travel involved. If you're an MP, you're going to live half your life in Saskatchewan, half your life in Ottawa. So part of it is, does this work with my family? Where there's several MPs I know who travel to Ottawa and they come home and their spouse manages the house system, manages the children, drives them everywhere, takes care of that other half of their life. Where that's much more challenging to be a female MP and to live half your life in Ottawa and come home and have someone taking care of that other half of your existence.
So how is it a matter of breaking down the door of that old boys club then in politics?
I think part of it is women supporting other women. Women generally do not manage to raise the same amount of funds for campaigning that men do. Part of that is the reason is that women who are supporting other women financially just make less money. And as women make less money at every level of education level, when you think about the average woman's earnings in dollars as of 2008, that was $44,700, and men's earnings in dollars is $62,600. That's 71% of women earn what men do. So we have less disposable income, so therefore we have less money to give towards political campaigns when women are running. So we can say that women support women, but we've only got so much money out there to financially support campaigns. And that's a big piece of winning and also just being to be able to be part of that election system.
Who would you say is responsible then or should be responsible to make that change? Should it be government? Should it be the people? Who should be responsible to help make the movement to get more women mm-hmm. involved?
I think as many countries have, we need to look at mandating through regulation and law that 50% of all women on corporate boards have to be women. 50% of all MLAs have to be women. 50% of all Ps have to be women. We're more than half of the population.
What do you think the backlash of something like that would be, though? Because if we did that, there would definitely be a reaction.
Yes. Yes. And we see countries all over the world that have the reaction. And 2 or 3 years later, the countries say, wow, this really worked. So you have that initial total resistance to this idea as to this can't work. But we know all around the world that's how it does work. We look at Rwanda. There's a reason that Rwanda has so many women in government is because they said, we are not going to allow this anymore. We lived through the Tutsi and the Hutu War and hundreds of thousands of people dying. We are going to change our country. And because we don't have any serious problems, we have problems, but we don't, according to the rest of the world, comparison-wise, we don't have serious problems. We sit back and say, you know, eventually there'll be enough women MPs. It will take hundreds and hundreds of years for us to move to a place that there's as many women MPs as male MPs if we just let it happen organically. So the question is, at what point are we going to say as a society that this is unacceptable?
How do we then force that issue? Because if we're going to wait 100 years, that's a long time.
Yes, but women still vote, and laws can be enacted, and it's about a government willing to initiate that. And there's many women's organizations, advocacy groups, who have advocated for this. It's not a new idea. It's been out there for 25, 30 years, the idea that we have mandatory equal representation. We have equal representation is not an odd idea. We have equal representation in our voting system. Every person has one vote. It's not a crazy idea that half of the women, half of the population is women, so half of the members of the House of Commons and half of the members of a board of directors that is federally regulated, as federally regulated boards are, should be women. That is not an outrageous idea. Many countries in the world adopt it. Many G7, G8, G20 countries have this kind of philosophy. And in hindsight, when you look down the road, they go, well, that made a difference. Our country is different. We have more equality because we did this. And so in a lot of ways, you know, you look at Canada, we like to think that we're one of the most proactive, that we're one of the most fair, equitable countries in the world. In many, many ways, that is true. But there's some things that we need to say, you know what, there's an elephant in the room and we're all ignoring it. And at what time are we going to do something about it and make some significant change? Because we know that the more women that exist in Parliament in any country, the more civil the debate becomes. It becomes a conversation as opposed to a mud-throwing activity, which for many people, I've sat in the House of Commons and I'm embarrassed to be a Canadian for the crap that goes on. And it's all for show, and it's all for media. And it was after the House of Commons began to be media recorded, first on the radio and then in television, that we began as a society to see a downward spiral of civility and actual discourse in the context of how we want our country to be led. So I don't think that it would be a bad thing. Yeah, there'd be lots of bitching, but we'd get over it.
I just want to touch on education as well, that in universities, we have almost equal numbers of men and women. But once you look at who's in what program, women tend to be more arts-based, men are more science-based. Yeah. So where is the issue then? We're in university, we have equal numbers, but it seems to be downhill from there.
Mm-hmm. In Canada, over 32%, for the last 10 years, over 32% of all MBA graduates were women. So there's really not a whole lot of reason why we don't have more women vice presidents when a third of the MBA's graduates are women. Now, what's interesting, though, is when we look at the OECD, of the top 34 countries, the OECD, we're number 32, which is, we're 30 out of 32.
Can you
say
what the OECD, OECD is?
You are going to ask me that tough question. I knew it.
Just explain a little bit, because so people know what we're talking about.
Yes, and it's the member countries that look at education and economic development.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the Organization for Economic Development. Aha, thank you. So when we think about that we place second from the bottom in graduation rates for girls for vocational and pre-vocational programs out of 32 countries. So what we're saying is out of those types of jobs, when we talk about the mining jobs, the jobs where you get ticketed trades, where you become a trade person, out of those types of jobs, which tend to be extraordinarily well-paying, I hate to think what plumbers and electricians make. Thank goodness I have a few in the family. But they make a significant amount of income compared to someone with a BA. And we are not doing a good job at all. We're doing a horrific job of getting young women into those programs, thinking about that kind of training, women into engineering programs, women into scientific programs. So we're doing a terrible job as a country in that area.
Okay, we're just going to take a short break here, and we're going to come back in a few minutes, and we're going to continue our a conversation. We're talking a little bit more about education, and then we're going to go and talk about the importance of women's programs.
Yeah.
That's Rodney DeCrew. Rodney was in town here about a month ago, and I got this CD. That was Bring It On. Good artist. I was kind of disappointed in the turnout at the club. We didn't have very many people there, and he's just fantastic. Anyway, let's carry on here. Jasmine.
Thank you, Jim. We are here today with Human Rights Radio talking about women's rights and equality, inequality for women, and we have Jeannie Martinson in studio with us. We ended before the break talking about education for women, and I want to get back to that. We had talked about women in university, but how does this start for women really at the base level, getting into education so that we can try and gain equality later in life?
Well, and we know from just studies around the world, we know that the more education women have, the more powerful they are in their society, the more choices they have. And with choices, they can do things as far as work opportunities that if they only have a high school education or less than a high school education, or have done education in an area that doesn't have a lot of well-paying opportunities, it really limits their ability. So when we think about, right, the very first step, what is the very first step in this whole process, I think is how young women, girls and young women, actually think about themselves monetarily. How do we think about money? How do we think about success? There's an event that Business and Professional Women Regina does here in Regina, and it's about 100 different women from all different kinds of jobs, all kinds of careers, some non-traditional, a lot of them non-traditional, and they match all these women up with between 300 and 800 high school girls. It's all done in one night. It's a bit of a fabulous event and a tiny bit of chaos, but totally fabulous. And it gives young women an opportunity to ask, okay, if I wanted to be a chiropractor, what would I have to learn? What would I have to take as far as university? Because when we think about opportunities, often if we don't know a woman in that role, we don't actually see that as a career opportunity. We think of it as a guy's job, especially for young girls. But this event, what surprised surprises me about this event that has been going on literally for decades is there will still be some young women who say, well, you know, I don't really know if I want to go to university or tech training because I'm going to end up being a mom. Or I'm planning on getting married and being a mom. And the challenge with that is that all sounds great, and the opportunity for women to stay home and raise their children is fabulous. I'm all for that. But life does not always deal us the best deck of cards. Sometimes we end up married. Sometimes we end up with husbands who pass on. Sometimes we get divorced. That happens. Sometimes we end up with someone who becomes disabled. And women, I think, always have to be prepared to be a breadwinner in their family system. And A, it gives them choice in a whole bunch of ways, but this whole idea that maybe I'm going to have a guy to take care of me, that still is existing in our society. And I think that that's particularly challenging. We need to address what those belief systems we have as young women. And in my first book, Lies and Fairy Tales That Deny Women Happiness, I did research looking at core fairy tales and what they teach us. You know, Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, Snow White. And some of the messages, particularly the good Disney messages, is that we wait for a man to come and rescue us, and what we want to happen in our life is dependent on that man coming into our life at the right time and making it work for us. It is not about self-direction. It's not about self-actualization, or in the case of strong women, finding a partner that respects them as an equal. If we have that as a belief system that determines how we see world and how we see work and how we see relationships. So we need to look at that first. Secondly, we need to have an education system that portrays women as being valuable in every single job that is possible in our economy, and not that there's still some guys' jobs and girls' jobs, which especially in smaller communities and rural communities and northern communities, I think that we don't have that opportunity for young women to see women in all kinds of diverse workplaces and all kinds of diverse type of work. And so if I don't see women in that role, can women even be in that role? And that, and at a logical, reasonable level, we go, of course, but we're talking about how it is that young women create their belief systems about how they think. Then we move into the next level, where particularly in non-traditional roles, and you go and you do technical training, but if the system there does not support women as electricians and women as engineers and women in the oil and gas industry, just going through that educational process can be very painful for women if the other students who might be in the program might be predominantly men. That might not be really an equal or respectful environment, because a lot of non-traditional type jobs have a little more of a rough communication style, and that's allowed. As opposed to white-collar work, which tends to be more respectful in how we talk to each other and how we respect each other. Certainly stuff like hazing, which is predominant still in a lot of non-traditional environments, ask any engineering student about that, still kind of exists. So then you get through the educational process, and then you get into the workplace as a non-traditional, a woman in a non-traditional role. Then if that workplace doesn't have some good, strong regulations about respect in the workplace, that too could create a situation where you're not really enjoying your job. So there's a lot of steps along the way where women don't necessarily have an equal opportunity just to be successful. And I think part of what you are mentioning is just the whole financial piece of it. And we know that women generally do not negotiate the same way men do. And women generally start at a lower salary when they're negotiating their first job. Even if you have yourself and a male student, you have exactly the same marks, exactly the same degree, chances are you will start your first job at a lower income than he will, just because of how men and women negotiate differently. Men are more likely to look at the range of a job and ask for something at the higher end, and women are more likely to wait for an offer and take it. And that's because of how we've been socialized as far as not speaking up for what we want, because up until, you know, 100 years, women didn't even have the vote. 50 years ago, women couldn't even sign contracts unless their husband signed them first. Like, I mean, it's not been forever that women have been in a position where they could just take charge of their life. And so we are trained by the generation before how to communicate in the workplace. And one of the big things that I think the president of BPW Canada, Kara Cote, was mentioning was that it's important that women have the ability to communicate in an equal playing field. And we actually need to teach young women in their careers how to negotiate effectively when it comes to salaries and opportunities.
Now, there's just a few things you mentioned in there that I want to go back to a little bit. When you talked about women being in non-traditional roles and jobs, they are starting to get more in the mining industry, the oil industry, something like that. How is the economy forcing that, in a sense, because there's no longer women now have to be a breadwinner, because a lot of households, they need two incomes.
There's a couple things there. One, in because we're in Saskatchewan and we're still in this, some people think, a boom, depending who you ask. But in here, what's pushing, I think, more women in non-traditional roles is the fact that we have a labor shortage. A lot of trades and technologies, we just don't have enough people going into those areas. So that has opened up the door for women in trades and technologies, and therefore it's a little more receptive than it used to be. And I've worked in all types of companies, and some companies are just better at this than others as far as being respectful to women in non-traditional roles. So that's one factor. In the context of the economy, I think that certainly outside of Saskatchewan, there's lots of situations where one or the other of a couple have lost their position. You know, you look at some of the jobs in Ontario, it's very different than how it is here. So in the sense that if there's two jobs and one of those jobs disappear, that second job is all that much more important to get the bills paid and the mortgage paid and put food on the table and that kind of thing. So I think in the sense that women's jobs have often been seen as a second income. And we see that reflected in what women do as far as sacrificing in context to their job. If you are both working, a husband and a wife, and you have two kids and the school calls because one of the children are sick, chances are it's going to be the woman who leaves work and goes and picks up that kid, not the man. Sometimes, but more so, it would be the woman doing that. So in the sense that that leads to us looking at women's careers as a second career, or least important, or less important, or not as important. And I think the economy has made us all kind of think a little bit more about that, and seeing that when there's two breadwinners in the family, how they both contribute equally, even if one is not making exactly the same amount of money as the other.
Would you say then that when you compared Saskatchewan to the other parts of the country, because our economy is doing well right now mainly because of natural resources, would you say that because of that, Saskatchewan is kind of getting ahead then maybe a little bit in terms of women in the workplace just because of a labor shortage?
Well, I think when you have downsizing, it's very easy to think about this issue. And when you have a boom, you have to think about this issue. So when we're in a boom and we don't have enough people coming into our workplace for the jobs that we have, we need to look everywhere as far as possibilities. Now, when we hire, particularly in the non-traditional field, although that's changing, but historically, we hire people that we know, we hire people who are families or friends, members of friends or family. And so let's just say you have six fellows working in a company, and they need a new apprentice. Well, who do you know? Well, my nephew's looking to get into this type of field. And because it's easy, that tends to be how we hire first, instead of saying, okay, let's do something more comprehensive. Let's identify who do we want to be coming into the company. Do we want to be more diverse? Do we want to look at, should we try and find an Aboriginal apprentice? Should we look at trying to find women who want to come into this role as an apprentice? Because it was just easier to say, well, who knows somebody? And so when there isn't anyone knows, and you have to look beyond the obvious of where you would hire someone, that's when you start seeing women coming into these non-traditional roles because the company has to search further and farther. So even, you know, that program I was speaking of, this Careers Unlimited evening that BPW Regina does here, is there several organizations that have booths there because they know they have to appeal to young female students because that's where their technicians and their tradespeople are going to come from in the future.
Is it just a matter of breaking that barrier then, and that is this where those stereotypes and discrimination comes in, where it's not the first person that comes to mind? Is it a matter of just breaking that, or is there something more?
I think it's slowly changing that I think if you thought about who is a water technician or who is an engineer, what is the typical picture that pops into your head might not be female, but I think we're slowly changing that. It's not that if I said, oh, that person's an engineer and they're female, that you would go, oh, really? That's strange. Then we know something is really non-traditional when we go, you're kidding me. And we're slowly seeing women in all kinds of non-traditional roles. We just don't have a critical mass where we're 20 or 30% of that particular field that it's becoming normalized. Because then what happens when things become normalized? It's not a non-traditional job anymore. It's a traditional job. You know, if you go back in history, there was a time that women were not secretaries. Only men could be secretaries. How did we get to this place? Was women entering that role, and in that case, kind of taking over that field, but in the sense that there's many jobs today that we don't consider non-traditional. We don't consider female physicians non-traditional. And yet at one time, that was very odd to have a female doctor. So as we kind of, I won't say invade tradition, I mean a non-traditional role, as women become as much employed in that role as men do, then that ceases to become a non-traditional role.
Do you think that it will become generational then, that once we make this change now, it'll stay that way? We'll be able to continue and the trend will only increase?
I think that we have been for the last 25 years in a serious way changing the roles that we've always thought of as non-traditional for women. I think there's more and more positions where women are in equal numbers, and I think that that only increases over time because there's more and more women taking post-secondary education, taking master's degrees, graduate studies, and so the education issue is coming closer and closer together. As I said, 32% of the people who have MBAs are women, so that'll just change over time. I think that in the sense where the work has to be done, A, is like I was talking earlier, I think we need to look at legislating as far as MPs, MLAs, and members of publicly traded boards. I think that that's personally something that I advocate for, and I think most of the studies out there that look at global issues in regards to women's issues would agree with that. So I think, one, it's that piece. Two, I think it's the education piece and encouraging young women and removing barriers for young women. There's many women's organizations that are very focused on raising money to give women bursaries so that they can move forward with their lives where they might not have the resources to get that post-secondary education. And thirdly, it's about working with the thoughts that we have in our own minds about what women's roles are, both in the workplace, both at home, and giving women choice, and that choice being okay. That if you want to have a career that you're very, very focused on and not have other pieces of your life that you spend a lot of time in, that's great. If you want to balance being a mother and having a career, that's great. If you want to balance having your own business and being a mother, that's great. The point is that we should not have attitudes about what being a good mother does when it connects to what does that woman do for a career. They don't relate to each other, because we don't set the standard, that high standard for men. We place a much higher burden on women and their responsibility to balance work and family than we do men. And I think that's as much from women's attitudes as it is men's attitudes. I think really a lot of this has to come from women supporting women.
And now, just speaking to the fact of women supporting women, there are a number of women's organizations that do just that. They support women. So what is the importance of this? So they support them, but why is it important that women know about organizations like that?
Well, I think that one, that women need to find mentors. And women aren't trained trained to search out mentors, and they don't know how to approach mentors, and they don't necessarily think that they're entitled to a mentor. And part of that is how we're socialized as children, because with and that's changing too with generations, because young women are playing more team sports, but certainly in the generations where women might be 35 and up, most of their activities of playing were in a type of game where you were leader until you screwed up and then you lost power, and that you rotated power, and secondly, that if you helped someone out, you expected for that to be reciprocated. So with young men, they were socialized more in team sports, that you were a leader until that leadership was taken away from you. It had nothing to do with your competence. It was about the rest of the system. And combined with the fact that because in team sports, you don't have an expectation that you're going to have to figure this out by yourself. Young men who played team sports always had a coach. It's not about being perfect. It's about being good enough to get on the team. And then someone there will help you improve. Where young women didn't have this coach metaphor. And so when we even apply for a job, we look at the list and go, well, you know, I can do this, this, and this, but this one, oh, not so great, so I better not apply. Where men are more likely to apply for positions that they, oh, I've heard of that. Why not? Let's throw my hat into the ring. The worst thing that could happen is I don't get an interview. Nothing gained, nothing lost. So even in the sense of how it is as far as our beliefs around should we step forward? Should we take the risk? Secondly, if I get the job, will there be someone there to coach me? So that ties to us as individuals in our careers being able to and have the skill set and the mindset and belief set to say, I deserve to be mentored, and the only way I'm going to be improved, or I'm going to improve, or one of the ways I'm going to improve is to have a coach. And so I'm going to go and look for a coach. And women are more likely to think, well, if you help me, I somehow need to help you. You know, you think about women, if I bumped into you and I said, oh, I'm sorry. You might say, oh, the chair was in the way. We try to balance relationships out all the time. That's how women are. If I bump into a fellow, I say, oh, I'm sorry. He might say, well, watch what you're doing. Because he doesn't see any responsibility in making me bring back that balance. That even if it wasn't your chair in the way, women are more likely to say, well, it was partly my fault. This relationship of balance that women pursue is not the same for men. And so when it comes to mentors, women are less likely to ask someone to mentor them unless they think that they could also be of some service to that person.
Is there a way then so that women, when they're looking for jobs, that they could be in contact with these women's groups right away to help right off the bat, to get them right from the ground running?
Yes. I think that there's, depending on the type of field that you're in, when you look at engineers or you look at CAs, or I'm not sure with CAs, but certainly there's different fields that they have women's association of something something. And so there's, in the sense, there's some that are very specific to different industries and different kinds of jobs. And so I think that women at the university level or even before that, to find where those groups are and talk to them. There's groups like Women in Technology. There's groups called like Women in Trades and Construction. There's different groups out there, and so really it's about finding where they are and connecting with them. And then there's general business groups, like I was saying, business and professional women, and there's a chapter here in Regina, and there's a chapter in Saskatoon, as far as here in the province. So there are some that are broader about women's careers and being supportive of helping you move forward in your career and supporting the choices that you make as far as work and family. And so I think part of it is choosing that quickly, like making that decision quickly as far as I'm going to go and search some advice out. I'm going to go search some information out.
Do you think it's a fact, though, that maybe women don't realize they need that help or that it's there for them? Because you mentioned a moment ago about power and attitude, that women have the attitude that why apply for this? I might not have this qualification, whereas men do it anyway. Is it a fact of maybe women don't know that maybe they should pursue something like this. Mm-hmm. That's an issue.
And I think that goes back to education. I think that young women at a high school level need to have, we talk about life skills, we need to have job skills because the workplace lends itself towards the leadership styles, towards negotiation styles. It's more predominant a male strategy than a female strategy. So I think women need to know how it is that you negotiate for a job. That should be something that we're taught in university. We need to understand how it is that you search out a mentor. And that should be part of the educational system itself. It shouldn't be that we're in university and trying to figure this all out by ourselves. And that's, I think, an unfortunate thing.
Do you think when you're talking about job coaching that in high schools and universities it should be different for men and women because we have different, we're going to face different issues once we enter the work field?
I don't know if it should be different for young men and women, but I think young women need to know that how they communicate might disadvantage them. An organization might be doing all the right stuff, but when it comes down to hiring a female and a male and they're giving an offer to both, a man is predisposed through cultural change, through cultural nurturing, to behave in a different way than that young woman is trained through cultural training to behave a certain way. And we need to be aware of that. So is it telling men the way you do is the way it works and telling women you need to be aware of this? Maybe. But maybe it's just in the context of women raising their daughters to understand about this, culturally, for us to be more aware of it so we can talk about it openly and understand what that dynamic is. I don't know who is responsible. I think society's responsible, parents are responsible, the student's responsible, education system's responsible to work towards that change.
Now, just in the few minutes that we have left before the end of our show, you had mentioned that there is some programs locally that women maybe should know about so that they could help themselves.
Well, I was mentioning that Careers Unlimited event that Business and Professional Regina does, and that is being held this year on November 14th, and it's held at the Kinexus Arts Center. And if you have a daughter or a niece or a granddaughter who is in high school in Regina or the greater area of Regina, encourage her to sign up for that. You sign up through your school counselor. They have all the application forms to do that. And it's a good opportunity to really hear all these different options that there is for women out there as far as careers and
So that was
ideas.
Wednesday night.
Is there anything coming up in December and in the coming year that maybe women could look to or just chapters locally?
Okay, well, thanks for reminding me
and
of that.
And here was well attended.
Here was well attended. Wow. See, that's what happens when I go out of town for a week. I miss something. I apologize for that. And any of my colleagues in this group who hear me, I no doubt will be getting emails rapidly because of that. So that's an event that's held every year. So as kind of going forward to think about that. In regards to BPW Regina, we have a club here. And the best person to contact there is Lindsay, and Lindsay is our vice president, and her number is 540-4945, 540-4945. And I think that in the context of particular programs as far as young women looking for mentoring, I think that they should kind of pursue as to what field that they might be interested in, find out if there is a group of women specifically in that area. And in regards to BPW, we're looking for any woman in any kind of role of field of endeavor who want to come and join our group because we're a lot of fun and very supportive for each other.
Once they get in contact with your group, what do you do to help them then?
Well, part of it is the networking. Part of it is we have monthly events throughout the year. And as well as, because BPW Regina is connected to BPW Saskatchewan, and we're part of BPW Canada, and BPW Canada is part of the International Federation of Business and Professional Women. We're a global organization with clubs all over the world, chapters all over the country, and there's lots of resources online, plus resources when we get together. There's annual national events of supporting women and helping understand what we still need to do from an advocacy perspective. The BPW Canada website has lots of resources on it as well.
Excellent. We have, I hope women can get in contact with those, and we have covered a lot of issues, so hopefully it will help women in the future. Thank you so much.
I'm glad to have been here.
That's great. Thanks very much, Jasmine. Thanks, Jeannie. And we're going to close this week's Human Rights Radio and CJTR Community Radio. We hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. For info on past and upcoming shows with links to human rights actions and information, go to amnestysaskatchewan.ca. Every Tuesday at 7 p.m., Amnesty letter writing happens at Atlantis Coffee at Victoria Avenue and Hamilton Street. Several Amnesty members will be present writing current Amnesty International appeals. Please feel welcome to join them for some letter writing. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."